Count your fucking knuckles, Stocky Man said. All of them? Jackie Brown said. Ah, Christ, Stocky Man said. Count as many of them as you want. I got four more. One on each finger. Know how I got those? I bought some stuff from a man that I had his name, and it got traced. And the man I bought it for, he went to MCI Walpole from 15 to 25. Still in there, but he had some friends. I got an extra set of knuckles. Then one of them stomped the drawer shut. Hurt like a fucking bastard. You got no idea how it hurt. Jesus, Jackie Brown said. What made it hurt more, the Stocky Man said. What made it hurt worse was knowing what they were going to do, you know? There you are. They tell you the very matter of fact that you made somebody mad, and you made a big mistake, and now there's somebody doing time for. And it isn't anything personal. You understand. But it just has to be done. Now get your hand out there. You think about not doing, you know? I was in Sunday school when I was a kid, and this nun says to me, stick out your hand. And the first few times I do it, she whacks me right across the knuckles with a steel-edged ruler. It was just like that. So one day I says, when she tells me, put out your hand, I say, no. And she whaps me right across the face with the ruler. Same thing. Except these guys weren't mad. They aren't mad at you, you know? Guys you see all the time. Maybe guys you didn't like. Maybe guys you did. Had some drinks with. Maybe looked out for the girls. Hey, look, Paulie. Nothing personal. You made a mistake. The hand. I don't want to have to shoot you, you know? So you stick out the hand, and you get to put out the hand you want. I take the left because I'm right-handed, and I know what's going to happen, like I say. And they put your fingers in the drawer, and then one of them kicks it shut. Ever hear bones breaking? Just like a man snapping a shingle. Hurts like a bastard. Jesus. Jesus. Jesus.
To the six, we be in the mix with that rare candy paint job on the whip. I need food for the kids, money for the rent. Fuck a lockdown, baby, I can't do that shit. And I don't never vote, cause I'm fucking broke. And either way, I know the police ain't gon' leave me alone. On a plane by the visit, Glenn Rockney. Crypto told me I should bring the Glock with me. So I packed up my piece and I'm sliding. Cause we might get caught up in a riot. Middle finger Trump, middle finger Biden. Fuck a left, fuck a right, is you riding? Know you love to see it, dudes rocking. Ain't no politics, baby, we just talking. From the birds to the bricks, we be in the mix. With that rare candy paint job on the whip, who you with?
Welcome back to the Gain of Fiction Lab. Here at the Gain of Fiction Lab, we take classic works of fiction, put them under a microscope, and then weaponize them against the general public. Today is a little bit of a different format, but I will say we're doing something a little bit different today. However, the haters are still bitter and salty that, you know, men are reading fiction and at this rate, and they're taking drastic measures. They're working with the police department to take us down. It's bad. It's bad. All of a sudden, you know, I feel like I'm riding home drunk from a Bruins game and the haters are behind me with a pistol. It's not great. It's not great, but we're going to power through it. So like I said, it's a different format today. And I have an author on and somebody I've wanted to talk to for a long time. So what we're doing here is we're taking one of his works and then we're talking about one of his favorite works. They're both really short. So any authors out there, hit me up because I'm down to do short work, multiple things for an episode. But today my guest is Max Thrax, author of God is a Killer, which we're going to talk about. Max, how are you doing this lovely Saturday?
I'm great. Thanks for having me in the lab.
It's good. It's good. You got all your PPE on. It's nice. Thanks for that. Thanks for abiding by the rules. But, you know, so you look, the cover of God is a Killer. I saw this advertised months and months and months ago by the good people at Apocalypse Confidential. And I was like, that's a really cool cover. I was like, that's a really cool cover. Then I, you know, I'd always followed you for a while, and you love book covers, like, more than most people, I feel like. I feel like you actually value the cover of books. Tell me about the cover of God is a Killer, how that came about.
The cover of God is a Killer. The book first came out with a British publisher called Close to the Bone.
Okay.
In late summer 2021. So that was the first edition of the book. It was not the alpha edition.
Yeah.
But I, You know, the guy who runs it, Craig Douglas, he's a super nice guy. I had a great time working with him. He usually does the covers for his books. But I decided that I wanted to, you know, use an artist of my own choice. So I went to Matthew Revert, who's done tons of book covers in the indie world. You'll see him a lot online. I mean, he's highly, highly respected. So I thought, well, if I'm going to get someone to do a cover, I want to get him. And it really helped because we have a lot of the same tastes in common. It wasn't just that he was a name that was out there, but he loves, you know, old paperbacks like Penguin paperbacks from the 60s and 70s. He loves Polish poster art. I love all the same stuff. So I thought, well, he'll probably know what I want. And, you know, to be honest, I didn't expect the cover to look like this because I sent him all these other samples of stuff that I wanted to look like, you know, like the Scarface poster, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
He went for in a much more, you know, design oriented direction, which is, you know, part of what he does so well. And when he sent it to me, I was just blown away by it.
Oh, I know. It's so cool. Like, so God is a killer, right? It's, I picked it up after I read Eddie Coyle because I wanted to just see, I wanted to see where the influence was, you know what I mean? And right away, the dialogue is your narrator, I feel like, in a sense, you know, like, and similar to a Higgins novel where it's like, you just feel like you're listening in, like, you feel like you're kind of peeping on people's conversation and learning things about these characters. And there doesn't seem to be one central character. I mean, there is, but it's kind of like in Pulp Fiction, in a sense, where you're just talking about a bunch of different scenarios kind of meeting at a climax. And so you said it came out in 2021 officially. Now, a guy like me is going to wait.
I'm sorry. It was 2022. I'm getting my years mixed up. It wasn't that long ago. I think I signed the deal with them in 2021. So
those years blended together more than any other years blended together. Sure. Let's say that much. But yeah, but anyways, a guy like me is going to wait for the Alpha Edition. Just, I mean, I don't feel like I don't have to explain that why, but I'm going to wait for the Alpha Edition. That has short stories in it at the end, Palm Sunday. And then a couple others that you have in there. And what's it been like, though? I hate to say like independent publishing. I don't know enough about publishing to say it's independent or major or anything. But I hear often the struggles with going indie, but then also the major publishers, they got a certain type of thing they want to publish right now. You know, like what's that been like to write what you want to write, but not be guaranteed to get the biggest audience unless it takes off? It's kind of on you, right?
Yeah, it's all on you if you're an indie writer to promote yourself. But the way I see it, it seems to be the same thing with the big five. I mean, if you sign up with them, you're expected to have your own audience already. They're not going to be doing too much for you. And True. If you don't live up to their expectations, they're going to drop you. If somebody from a big publisher out of the blue came to me and said, hey, we'd love to publish your book. I mean, I'd have a pretty good idea of what would be in store for me. So that doesn't really tempt me. I try to be realistic about this stuff.
At the end of the day, it's your work. Like, you have to be happy with it, you know? I don't begrudge anybody who wants to go with a major publisher and try to get their big hit, you know, that maybe had, but again, the audience you already bring is going to warrant your promotional budget from what I gather. Like, so it's even like you already have to have people that are waiting on this book. And it sucks. Music's like that too. I would imagine film is the same way, where it's like, no, why don't, you know, publishers, when we're working in a, I feel like when we're firing on all cylinders, it's like, no, the publisher needs to go like, God, there's something there with that guy. You know, maybe we'll make sure people see it, but there's something there with that guy and we need to get that book out there. But it just doesn't seem like it's that type of game. But Apocalypse Confidential is doing really cool things with that. I think it's great. Incurable Graphomania is great. I finished that recently. And it's just, they're putting out a lot of cool stuff. And I think there seems to be a big thing of free. There seems to be a something that Jacob is going for that he wants, but there's so much freedom from the individual people. Everybody's really different, I feel like, there.
Absolutely. Well, the genius of Jacob is that he tapped into something, to a big audience that was already out there, but that nobody was really looking at or trying to serve or trying to, you know, publish. So when he started doing Apocalypse Confidential, without even knowing it, I wanted to be a part of it. And then when he asked me, you know, initially to be fiction editor, I couldn't believe it. You know, I just said yes right away because that's what I wanted to be doing, to be involved with something like that and to work with guys like Jacob.
Yeah, well, highly. You know, there seems to be a new theme every couple of months that they're going for. Sometimes it goes into the paranormal. There's so much cool crossover, especially with this program. So I do try to go out of my way to work with Apocalypse Confidential people or adjacent people. That we've had plenty of contributors on, including the man Jacob himself, Jacob Everett. He's been on the show. But God is a Killer. This is interesting because right off the bat, it's hitting you in the head with scripture and religion. And I'd love to, do you have a background? I mean, are you a papist? You a man of the, did you grow up in the church, I guess?
I went to church a bit as a kid. My parents were not papists. They're actually Eastern trads. So Greek.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, my dad's side is Greek and Russian. So we had, most of that was cultural, though. I mean, we had icons in the house, but neither of my parents were really religious, you know. So after a while, I think my dad got into some kind of dispute with the priest there, and from what I heard, and we just ended up not going back to church. So, you know, as I've grown older and as an adult, you know, I've gone to church, you know, just by myself. We went back when I actually lived in the city of Boston. I lived not too far from, you know, what's the biggest church in the New England Archdiocese down there by the Art Museum. I used to walk down there on Sundays and then go to the museum right after we got out. So that would be like a really nice Sunday morning. But I mean, I haven't been in a while, but it's, you know, if you grow up like that, I mean, it does stick with you a bit. And it's,
yeah,
people have discovered it now. They've discovered Eastern Orthodoxy. You know, you see that.
I've noticed that. I did. That's not out in California. I mean, maybe it is, but I just don't see all the gold everywhere. Like, I don't see that. Maybe just a couple places we have out here in like woodsy areas. They seem to be in a lot of woodsy areas in California. Is kind of like some of the Orthodox churches. But that is like a completely different world to me. I go on Twitter and like a bunch of people are like talking about it, it's completely different. But so, you know, the book is very action-packed, and I will say it comes in at what, 129 pages. That I think is that, are you conscious when you write something short like that, are you conscious that people, maybe you're dealing with phones and keeping people's attention and things like that? Because I know a lot of people, a 400, 500 page novel is what stops them from reading a lot of times, because it involves them to put everything down and just concentrate on something. And this is a book you can read in a couple of days, I would say. And especially towards the end, you're going to not want to put it down. So are you conscious of like maybe attention spans, or is this just how it works?
I think it's a bit of both. I am conscious of attention spans, but it's also just part of the form that I'm working in, hard-boiled crime. I'm going for velocity. You know, I'm influenced by guys like Higgins, and also, you know, you can go back to, you know, the Black Mass guys, you know, Dashiell Hammett, Paul Kane.
Yep.
You just hurtle through these books because they're able to compress the action. So, you know, the first time I read Maltese Falcon, I couldn't believe how much action Hammett had compressed into just 15 or 20 pages. I'd never read anything like it. And that's when I think I really started getting interested into hard-boiled crime fiction.
I'm interested to pick up some Hammett, man. I haven't done it yet, and he's a San Francisco guy, man. I really have to, you know. Yeah, I got to. Yeah, he wasn't available to come on the episode, sadly. He didn't. He never hit me back, but don't know what's going on there. But the action. I mean, it's funny. You know, you'll read like some literary fiction, and everyone's waiting for like the thing to happen. But you pick up some hard-boiled crime, things are gonna happen. You know, like if you want things happening. And I love them as kind of palate cleansers, because I'm coming off of 800 page sci-fi epics, you know, which I love. I love both. I love the short kind of like cigarette length novels. You know, I love those. In fact, those got me back into reading. And then I love, you know, I love the big kind of like torturous kind of Stockholm syndrome you get from like a long literary novel. Both scratch the itch. I will say that it's been a while since you've been reading, get into crime fiction, like get into it. And I think some people, where they go wrong is when they haven't read in years, they've, you know, had a bit too much screen time or whatever, and don't feel like they have time to read. They automatically, when they pick up a book, they pick up something like intentionally tough and sloggish. I feel like they feel like the need, because maybe that's what they read years ago, or it feels like a signifier. But for me, I love crime fiction, and I hate when people say genre fiction as like kind of a slur, you know, like kind of like, oh, well, it's genre, you know, it's kind of genre fiction, it's kind of crime fiction. So it's like, no, it's great, you know?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of that stuff is excellent. And especially if you look at the first wave of hard-boiled crime writers, you know, they didn't grow up reading or writing hard-boiled fiction. You know, they were the guys who were doing it for the first time. So,
right.
They came from all different kinds of backgrounds. And what you're talking about is something that Higgins personally struggled with his entire career, because he didn't see himself as a crime novelist. He knew a lot about crime because he'd been a U.S. attorney. You know, he knew these bank robbers up close. You know,
they walked,
all that stuff. So to him, when he wrote Friends of Eddie Coyle, he was just writing a realistic, you know, naturalistic novel about bank robbers, something that he knew very, very well. But it was a big success. And then all of a sudden he's like, shit, I'm a crime novelist now. he liked crime fiction. He liked Hammett. He liked Chandler. But that's not how he saw himself. And it dogged him his entire career, because he felt that the general reader who might have liked his novels never saw them because they're in the crime section. But a hardcore thriller reader or a hardcore mystery reader is not going to dig his stuff so much, because it's mostly dialogue.
It's so much of it is. And your book has a lot of it too. And now your book is cool. I have a question about God as a Killer, because I was trying to find out, and I kind of, if I missed it, I missed it. What year is this happening?
It's the recent past. The year isn't specified. But
yeah, but it's pre. I feel like it's a slightly pre-smartphone. Am I?
I'd say maybe like on the cusp. The thing about smartphones is that even if you're writing about a world where smartphones exist, you don't need to put them in the book.
No, it ruins your book.
That's my philosophy.
And it ruins your book because you get like those like Reddit type people that'll just be like, well, I mean, they would have known where McDougal was because they could have tracked him, because McDougal would have, you know, eventually you have to have a phone, and you know, you'd have these. You'd have like all these people. I've listened to authors all the time talk about it's really hard to write mysteries right now because we have a device that basically ruins all mystery.
it could be, but there's still plenty of mystery. There's still plenty of gangsters out there committing crimes. You know, like this stuff, it gets exaggerated in my opinion. You know, because they assume that, you know, the police are this omnipotent force that know everything and can track down every criminal. I mean, maybe eventually they do track them down, but sometimes it takes a while, and a lot of cases still go unsolved. You know, that hasn't changed.
And sometimes the sheriff is like in on the meth trade.
Exactly.
You know, so your book, it's centered around a few characters. There's Sheriff Fitzroy, there's McDougal, the kind of wild man preacher, ex-con. You have Sarah and you have Timmy. Now Timmy is Timmy's one of the boys. I feel like I could have fixed Timmy. You know, I could fix him. You know, he's a good guy, because I liked his. You brought in some Oregon. I haven't seen that in a novel before. We'll talk about where do you research these things, or is this something like you're into or something? Because
no, I'm not personally into. I've never actually used an Oregon accumulator.
It wouldn't be weird if you were, because look at the show you're on. I'm just saying, we have people that are into weirder stuff. So
I did some research on the accumulators to figure out how they were actually built, so I could write about it in the book. I was familiar with them through Wilhelm Reich and through William Burroughs, because Burroughs was quite fond of Oregon accumulators. So I was familiar with it through those kinds of guys. And then I just thought, well, if, you know, Timmy, if he doesn't have this cult available to him anymore, he's going to get into something weird. So it's the Oregon accumulator.
I know. That was a pleasant surprise seeing that in there. Cause that's, again, like even a lot of hard boiled stuff. Like I think there's an avenue right now for even the dilemma that we were talking about is the phone. We can't write now because of the phone. Well, to me, I kind of think that there's an avenue for, and I think Apocalypse Confidential kind of goes on this a little bit, but the idea of kind of like high strange, hard boiled, like I think there's an avenue for that that isn't explored enough. If it is, I haven't seen it and I'd love to know about it, but like the kind of like, okay, there's something weird going on. There's guys building weird machines, but I still have this very familiar classic law enforcement guy that I kind of like, kind of hate, you know, like I think there's an avenue for that. And I definitely, that itch gets scratched in God as a Killer. Cause you know, you have biker meth gangs, you have cult escapees and all that. And that's for me as a California guy, I know this does not take place in California at all. It's quite the opposite side of the country, but for me, it's, we have that out here. We have these like woodsy, biker, methy, like highway guys that just, we have albinos. Like we have albinos that live off the highway that like, I think might cook meth too. It's crazy. And it's, that's exactly where I'm transported and stuff. These woodsy areas, like a couple parts of your place, it reminded me of like those like Sopranos, like where, you know, the place where in Sopranos where Ralph Cifaretto's kid gets like hit with the arrow.
Yeah.
That's like where I picture some of this stuff happening, but then like parts of it in a way trashier part of the woods, you know.
Like, yeah, there's plenty of it up here as well, especially in New Hampshire. I mean, Weir's Beach is where all the bikers meet up every year. Mm. There's plenty of them both there and in Quebec. Like the biker wars in Quebec in the 90s were insane.
Whoa.
And yeah, like, you know, probably like 150 people got killed. You know, it's just, and they didn't shoot each other. It was, they would make these bombs and they would just try, whoa, to blow each other up. Yeah, it was these really intense biker wars that went on for, you know, probably 10 or 15 years.
Over territory or like
what? Yeah, over the drug trade in Montreal.
Damn.
That's what they were fighting over.
Damn, dude, can you imagine getting hit with a bomb? Like, yeah, just, I don't know. I'm not, you're not expecting that. This is just, we don't do that in the West, I feel like a lot, but I guess we do. But the, yeah, no, it's wild. You don't know what happens in the woods, man. I, like I said, I, like California has every kind of terrain you could ever ask for. And you get in the woods and it just, it immediately feels like you have to learn a new language. So I love the setting and the scenery of God is a Killer. But, and then, I think, you know, it's tough to tell. I'm always hesitant to tell the authors that they're influenced by somebody, 'cause I don't want to make it sound like they're copying somebody, but I don't think that's true at all. Like, I think it just, the fact is you have no choice but to be influenced by what you like. So, and it's good to keep the energy of certain authors going, but with your own spin. And I, after reading The Friends of Eddie Coyle, just the pacing of God is a Killer, I just feel like the pacing, which is the best part of The Friends of Eddie Coyle, I think is there. And I think that reaches out to a lot of people who maybe haven't read in a while, or are competing and trying to get off the devices and stuff, because it's just one after another, but you're also still learning about these characters at the same time. So I wonder, how do you stop from like completely just five pages on why this guy's bad, his history and everything? And how do you decide whether you're going to write five pages of prose about why, you know, McDougal is a crazy guy? And then you realize, oh, I can just do that through dialogue. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want you to say how you do it, but like, is it tempting to just be like, do it in a classic literary format?
Well, I think I have a dramatic imagination, so dramatizing these things is very easy for me. And it, you know, it just, it can only increase the velocity.
Yeah.
So I try to use as little exposition as I can, try to use as little description as I can, and just let the characters tell the story, which is pretty much what Higgins tried to do, and which is, and, you know, kind of an ideal, I think, within hard-boiled crime fiction.
Yeah.
So you want the reader to figure out the story. You're not telling the reader the story. It's much more powerful if you show them. That's not just, you know, an adage or a cliche. If you want to convince something of somebody, you can tell them or you can show them that what you're saying is true. So which one's going to be more persuasive? It's always going to be more persuasive to show them.
Also, there's so much, it's so much more fun, because this is kind of like hard-boiled stuff is kind of like hard-boiled crime fiction. Especially when it gets really like pulpy, I think that those are like romance novels for men. Like, I think we get a little kind of like, no, we get that, like, we get to act like ladies for a little bit. We get to kind of like stick our ears in there. Ooh, what are they talking about? You know what I mean? Ooh, I heard from so-and-so that's this. You know, this book, and then with like Eddie Coyle especially, like, you feel like you're an agent in a sense where you're like gathering information. Rather than just, you know, and I love James Ellroy, but James Ellroy is just going to like, oh, a year went by and here's like, seven newspaper clippings of what happened in the last year. He's a master of that, but I don't think anybody else really can do that. It's so much better to do it just with characters talking, because like, we love that. Like, it's like workplace stuff. It's like, hey, did you hear so-and-so said that, you know, so-and-so, you know, we're gossip, and men gossip, man. And that's like what I feel like a lot of like hard-boiled crime fiction is like male gossip, but like cool. You know?
Yeah. Well, no one loves to gossip more than gangsters do. Although they're probably the last people that should be doing it.
Right. That's it's a taboo. So, there's a taboo element to it. Yeah.
So, and it does really feel like there's some Title III surveillance going on when you pick up Friends of Eddie Coyle, or, you know, hopefully when you pick up God is a Killer.
No, it's there. No, it's absolutely there, because you're like, huh, like what's, you know, what's the deal with this whole, like this lady and a kid that's not her son, but like you find it out, but there's not just a like, well, there's a little bit of it, but there's not just a page of here's what happened. You know, here's the backstory and stuff. It's like, no, you get it through these interactions, and you're able to get your gears turning a little bit and kind of just kind of, and you can fill in your own blanks a little bit too. I like when I don't know the Wikipedia early life section of a lot of characters. I like to be like, ah, they're probably this. Ooh, I picture this type of person, you know. It's very, very fun. So before we move on to Eddie Coyle, just let everyone know where they can get God as a Killer.
So right now you can get God as a Killer in both paperback and ebook on Amazon.
Very nice. So the ebook is like Kindle, right?
Yeah.
I just got one. I've submitted to the Kindle life. I have no more room for books. I have this shelf, and I have a one bedroom apartment. I like the Kindle. It is cool. I'm reading something on there right now, and it feels like it feels sinful a little bit, like, but the ebook is the way. It is the way, because I'm like, the reason I'm doing this is the screen. The reason I love reading is because there's no screens, and then I'm reading, and I'm like, but it's also addicting, like a screen. So I can like knock out like 70 pages when I would normally read like 40, because I'm like, hey, you have that phone addiction thing, like that when you're reading a Kindle. It's strange, man.
Yeah, I should buy a Kindle, but I think I just, you know, I grew up going to used bookstores, and I just love books as aesthetic objects too much. And yeah, there are piles, and I've gotten rid of many more books than I have, and I still have too many.
I know, and it's like, for me, my rule now is like, if I because I don't like a lot of the book covers that I have, because they are just like senior center libraries. Like, oh, my, you know, my dad died and here's all his books. But, you know, they didn't have like the best cover. So sometimes I will go get the Kindle version of that, because I'm like, this book just, you know, especially like these new Kurt Vonnegut covers that are like Easter pink and stuff. It was just very strange.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on in the design world.
It's bad.
Nothing's going on in the design world. Right?
Well, and that's your account. I mean, your account, you post like, I mean, incredible alternate book covers of stuff I haven't seen, other countries, you know, like European editions of books. And it's like the biggest thing you learn as a kid, and I understand they're talking about like people when they say this, but, and it's a metaphor, but they're like, you can't judge a book by its cover. It's like, well, a literal book, I can. I feel like, if I'm looking at a cover of something and it just, that's not a good cover, someone's got to tell me auxiliary information about that book for me to actually pick it up and buy it.
Right, and it's the same thing with my account. We were talking about earlier about showing and telling. I'm not going to be this like trad guy or some blowhard going on Twitter saying, "Oh, you know, modern book covers suck," like blah blah blah. You know, a lot of them do.
Yeah,
but what I'm gonna do is show you some great
ones. Yeah, cool ones. Yeah, so yeah.
Anything is possible in the future.
Yeah, I do really appreciate.
Yeah, you don't have to copy the past, but you can know that there are alternatives to what's there today.
I do appreciate that you're not a guy that just lays out a plate of oysters and raw milk and then puts you know, a Philip K. Dick cover from France right next to it with like a girl's hand that we don't ever meet. Yeah, I'm glad you don't do that. So
the thing I can do to help.
Let's get off of that, because it's wow. Fellas, we're not e-girls. Yeah, I knew this guy. Met him when I was at Lewisburg on that federal thing back there 3-4 years ago. Forget what he was there for. B&E in a federal building, maybe post office job. Anyway, not a bad guy. Big. Used to box some. He comes from down around New Bedford there. So we strike up a friendship. I get out first, Dylan said. I come back here. I let him know where I am. So when they parole him, he goes home to live with his wife and her mother, but he knows where I am if he needs to get a hold of me. And it wasn't very long before he needed to, because those two women went right to work driving him out of his mind. Dumb Portuguese types, you know? And what did they do when he was in jail, but they decide they don't want to be Catholics anymore? They're going to be, what is it, Jehovah's Witnesses. Beautiful. Guy comes home, knows the construction business pretty good, gets himself a job. Every night he comes home, there's maybe a ball game on or something, and they want him to go out and stand on the sidewalk in front of the supermarket, peddling Jesus to every poor bastard that comes around to get a pound of fish. So he starts coming up here, Dylan said. Every chance he gets, just to have a little peace and quiet. Next thing I notice, he's coming up this one time, and he doesn't go back. So I say to him, "What are you doing here?" And he says, "For Christ's sake, You ain't gonna start on me, are you? Me, are you? Me, are you? Me, are you? But let's get into our main source material of the day. We're talking about the Friends of Eddie Coyle. Now, I knew for a long time when I wanted you on this program, I knew this would be what we'd talk about. I didn't think it'd be a very tough sell, even though we didn't know each other all that well. I found out about this book. I thought I found out about it from Quentin Tarantino, but I can't find the clip where he's talking about it. So I'm like, maybe I didn't. But I know he loves Higgins. So I don't know. Maybe I heard about it when he was on Brady Stenellis, and it was just a jumbled thing in a bunch of things. But when did you first read it?
I read it after I saw the movie.
And yeah, me too. Mm-hmm.
I had never even heard of the movie until the Criterion released their edition in 2009.
Wow!
Because there were some, I knew some old heads around Boston who were very excited about it coming out. So
nice.
I thought, well, you know, I love Training Day. I love The Departed, and I was like, well, I need to check this out.
You just listened to a preview of one of our premium episodes, and to get access to the full thing, you've got to be a paid subscriber to the Rare Candy Substack. That's rarecandy.substack.com. It's only $5 a month or $55 for the whole year. You get 1 month free if you do the whole year. You get access to premium Rare Candy episodes, my podcast, The Glenn Word, and whatever the hell else we want to charge people for. Again, that's rarecandy.substack.com. Thanks again.